I have a husband who I love very dearly, and I have three children whom I love very dearly. The way that I can love my children most is by loving my husband.
This is Christianity at Work, the radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. In this program, Dr. Jack Crabtree and marriage and family therapist Christine Barber continue the discussion on the many ways we may break our marriage vows. The marriage commitment is our highest human loyalty. And yet all too often, we make our children or our friends more important than our spouse. Let's listen to Jack and Christine as they discuss how the vows of marriage demand commitment above all other human relationships.
So Jack, here we are back again talking about one of our favorite subjects, which is marriage.
Yeah.
And we have, of course, been going through a series that's called Breaking Our Marriage Vows. Our marriage vow implies many things. It implies that we will strive to be connected to the other person. That is, that we'll become one flesh with them. Our marriage vow implies that we'll respect our marriage partner as another who is an individual corresponding to me. Not me, but another person, and respecting that other personness of theirs. Our marriage vow also implies that we make our spouse our highest human loyalty. We talked a lot about that last week. Today we're going to talk about it again. There are many ways that we can not make our spouse our highest human loyalty. We talked some about that last week. Today what we'd like to talk about, at least start with, is how we can sometimes make our children our highest human loyalty. The husband can do this, and the wife can do this, or they both can do that to a child. So how do I make a child my highest human loyalty? How do I make them a bigger loyalty over my spouse? What does it look like?
Children are incredible delight to parents. It's probably instinctual. God made us to find a real joy in our children. And I'm not sure I've analyzed all the reasons why. They are like us. Sometimes they remind us of ourselves.
And sometimes we don't like that.
Yeah, sometimes we don't like that.
Lots of times we don't like that. Sometimes we really like that.
Yeah. It's very complex, I think, very complicated thing. But I think just the bottom line is children tend to be really delightful to parents. Unless there's something very desperately wrong with us as parents, we're going to find a great deal of reward in watching them grow and delighting in the things they learn and accomplish and what they're capable of, the talents that unfold out of their lives. We just take great pleasure in watching all that stuff happen. Well, when you find yourself in a situation where you're really being delighted on an ongoing and continual basis by your children, on the one hand, and then you have this relationship with your spouse over here that's proving to be a lot of work. And there's some significant pain and some significant sorrow and disappointment that's coming out of that relationship. It's just very easy to decide, my life is going to be about my children. My life is going to be invested there. It's too much work to invest it in my marriage relationship.
You know, I really think that's the genesis of a problem that develops is, when my marriage really isn't going well, I'm very disappointed in it. I might be very angry. It's just not what I wanted it to be. And so I focus on a child.
Mm-hmm. Our children are getting old enough that they're beginning to move out of the home. Our dog barked at 4:00 in the morning the other day and woke my wife up, and she went down to quiet the dog, and she was telling me the next morning that it was a very kind of unnerving experience for her, because she just realized how quiet the house was. Two of our kids were gone. We only have two children left. And the house just seemed so big and empty to her right now. And it started her thinking, you know, what is life going to be like in just a few more years when our children are gone and they are not her main occupation anymore? What is her life going to be like? And it just reminded me of a problem that you hear people talk about a lot, you know, the empty nest syndrome, where women in particular, but I think it can be true of men as well, where they have given of themselves for so long to their children, and that has been their occupation, that has been their life, and now all of a sudden that part of their life is virtually over. I mean, you never stop mothering your children, but the actual dailiness of it grinds to a halt. And what is your life about now? If the wife has not, and if the wife and husband have not been investing in one another over the course of that time, I think oftentimes they can find themselves with no relationship left, nothing there to carry on with and to build on. And that's a real tragedy. There needs to be a relationship there that can enter into a new phase, into a new adventure, into a new challenge, and their life will be different, but they have a relationship there to do this different thing from, you know.
Yeah, if their relationship has been distracted by overemphasis on a child, either in a negative way, because they're always finding the child being the problem, the child becomes the problem of the relationship and therefore the focus, and perhaps that serves the husband and wife to not have to focus on each other and their issues, they focus there. Or if they have focused, one or the other or both have focused on the child as a means of their emotional support and sometimes even physical support, what they find is an emptiness in the marriage when the children leave. But let's talk a little bit more, Jack, about what happens when husband or wife becomes very incestuously, emotionally incestuously involved with a child. Let's talk about what that looks like. It can look lots of different ways. Do you have some ideas to throw out first?
Well, why don't you answer that? You probably have more experience with that than I do.
That's the way to toss the ball back.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I do have quite a bit of experience with that. I see a lot of children who have come from that, adult children who have come from that kind of environment. And on one hand, being a child who is the chosen one, being the princess, the little girl being the princess to the dad, is on one hand just a delightful experience for the child. They feel special. They feel set apart. They feel like they're really very much on top of the world on one hand, because they're getting all the attention and all the delight of, in this case, the father. However, problems erupt as a result of that also. A major problem is very often the mother is very, the mother of the child can be very angry and very jealous at the child who's getting all the attention from her husband. She may be very angry, she may be very bitter, it might come across in very subtle ways, or it might come across in very big and angry ways.
Hostility toward the child?
Strong hostility toward the child, because in a sense they're experiencing their husband being married to their child.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be apart from any kind of physical involvement on the part of the husband with the child. It can just be certainly just a strong emotional tie that he has broken with his wife. Now, I'm not picking out men as the only ones that are doing this. I'm just using it as an example to talk through this for right now.
Right.
Some other things that might occur. And so what happens is the child, in all intents and purposes, really doesn't have the kind of mother she needs. So in the husband taking on an inappropriate role with the child, she's not having a dad. She's also not having a mom.
So he's stealing her mother away from her.
And he's actually stealing her father,
right, exactly,
away.
Yeah.
And having this kind of pseudo-marriage with the child. You can imagine lots of awful things that could happen apart from only the mother being hostile and losing them. But she also has this inappropriate role that she's had to take on. Instead of being a child, playing, somewhat carefree, growing up in a natural way, very often it zooms the growing process up. Not really, but in a pseudo way. I all of a sudden go from a child to being an adult with adult responsibilities, hearing about my dad's anguish over his relationship with my mom, what he doesn't like about my mom, his financial problems. The weight of adulthood is on me, and I get reinforced being a child that can take it on.
Let me see if I'm clear on what's going on here in this relationship then. Is the husband, the father, is, you're calling a quasi-marital relationship, confiding in the child, in things that the child is really not emotionally equipped to handle. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not the child's world, but the father is just sort of looking at the child as if she were a spouse almost. Mm-hmm. and talking about intimate things, confiding in the child, looking to the child for happiness,
mm-hmm.
a requiring of the child that they keep him happy, and mm-hmm. stuff that that more typically he would look to his wife for then. That's what you're talking about.
That's exactly right.
Huh.
Good description. And really what you said is taking a child out of a child's world and putting the child in an adult world. And it's a tragic thing. We all need to have childhood worlds. It's just the same that we need to crawl before we walk. In a physical way, we need to be children emotionally and crawl through that stage of our lives and then, over time, become an adult.
Hmm.
So many times when I work with these people, they have this kind of empty... They have, on one hand, they have a very strong sense of responsibility and adulthood, adult feeling, mature. On the other hand, there's this strong immaturity that's often pretty covered up, and they can't figure out why they can't work. Some things don't work for them, but they don't, and they're really in kind of a confused place. You know, another problem that often does relate to this or come out of this is that siblings who are not chosen as the partner, the quasi-emotional married partner to one or the other of the parents, are very angry at the child that is. And so it can set them up for the child up for a lifetime of not having siblings. Siblings that are very angry, very jealous. And that can go far into their adulthood. And sometimes those are scars that will never be changed. And it isn't the child that created this situation, it's the parents that do it. And the parents really need to take on the responsibility of not doing this to a child. The parents need to be married to each other. They need their primary focus to be on one another and not on the children.
When you're talking about this kind of emotional incest, is it a parent, you've talked about in terms of a parent being married to a child, is it possible to be married to more than one child?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Mother or the father could very much take them over, all the children, over onto his or her camp and leave the father out, or leave the mother out. And so there, the other spouse is very much on the outside, and this spouse is very much on the inside with the children. It's really a tragic thing. Also, I'm thinking about a situation that I'm involved or have been involved in with somebody in my counseling, where he was very much taken along with his brothers over onto the father's side, and the father would talk against the mother all the time, just railed against the mother and her selfishness, and just talked about things that he didn't like about her. And so my client grew up thinking that his mother was a horrible beast, just really hated his mother. Well, I made the suggestion a few weeks ago that what about your father saying all these things about your mother? Do you think that had any impact on your observation of who your mother was, and maybe kept you from having your own observations? And the reality of that struck him really big. All of a sudden, he realized that maybe his mother wasn't all those things, that he was only seeing his mother through his father's eyes, and that had never given his mother a chance in his whole life. As a result, he called his mother up and has decided to forge his own relationship with his mother. But now he's 40 years old, and there is a lot of anger that he's had, and a lot of sadness and anger that she's had toward him. And so they have a really long road to go. Let's take a break and come back in a few minutes.
Christine Barber is a licensed marriage and family therapist. More than that, she is a woman committed to knowing and applying the truth of God's Word to everyday life. She has spent years working alongside others as they discover the truth of who they are and then try to pursue life with love and wisdom. Dr. Jack Crabtree is a philosopher by training, a Bible teacher, pastor, and professor by profession. If you spend a short time with Jack, you quickly learn he is a seeker of truth and a man with a deeply passionate love for God's Word. For years, he has studied and taught the Bible at churches in California and Oregon, as well as the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene. Both Jack and Christine are convinced the Bible is the true Word of God.
Before the break, I was asking you about if I have an emotionally incestuous relationship with a child, is that going to be always with one child or could it be with many? And I'm still a little bit confused, and maybe you could help me here. Is there a difference between forging a sort of quasi-marital relationship with one of my children and just asking for their loyalty over against my spouse? I don't know if I'm clear in my question, but it...
Can I kind of have a quasi-marital relationship with four children?
Right.
Or can I only have it with one? And I guess my answer would be either or. I think I really could forge a quasi-marital relationship with a number of children. I would think, though, it's more often that I'll just have my own team. I'll ask for the loyalty of my children just for myself and hold those away from my spouse.
And so if that's happening, that's not really what we're calling emotional incest. That's a different problem. It's us, me and the kids ganging up against my wife, or me and the kids ganging up against my husband, more than it is a real incestuous relationship.
Yeah, I would say so. That's a good distinction.
Okay.
Also, in an emotionally incestuous relationship, let's go back to that. An emotionally incestuous relationship can turn into a physically incestuous relationship. And when we think of physically, oftentimes we think of intercourse. And I'm not specifically talking only about intercourse or only about
sexual intimacy. Yeah.
But things like inappropriate touching, inappropriate looking, inappropriate talking about sexual things. There is a physical component that is really inappropriate and very hurtful to a child. I remember one time in a discussion talking to you about a child that I work with once who did not, in fact, have a father, only had a mother. And the mother would invite the child into her bedroom in the morning and ask the child to rub her legs. She would hang her underwear in his bathroom. She walked around without clothes some of the time. And although there wasn't any, she didn't touch him sexually, she asked him to be involved with her in a physical way that was completely inappropriate.
And that's what you mean by a physical component. There may be some boundaries that are set where it doesn't cross over what we would typically think of sexual intimacy, but there's always a kind of innuendo, there's always a kind of undercurrent of sexual suggestiveness that in the way that the parent is behaving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that can even be more confusing on a mental or emotional level to a child, because they can say, well, I was only being warm and loving to my parent. There really wasn't anything that went wrong. But there really was something that went wrong. And very often people have to do a whole lot of working through and looking at what occurred to understand why they are behaving in the way they are toward their spouse now as adults, or why they're confused in terms of their sexual identity. Those kinds of issues can come up, and it can be very confusing.
I think maybe we've talked about this before, but you see over and over again a theme coming up when we talk about sexuality, that there's so much that goes on between people that has to do with our underlying attitude. You know, there on the one hand, there's a kiss of affection. On the other hand, there's an erotic kiss. On the one hand, there's a look of affection or even respect or kindness, or there's a look of desire. And they're very, very hard to define. It's very easy for us to look at what's going on and say, I'm not doing anything wrong, because outwardly, I'm only looking at them. The activity could be described from the perspective that makes it seem really, really innocent. But in fact, if my heart and mind and soul is going one direction, we communicate that to other people. It does get communicated in a subtle and intangible kind of way, but other people often pick up on what's really going on there in the look or in the touch or in the kiss or whatever. And I think if we're going to deal with sexuality at all, we really have to come to terms with that reality, that what we do physically gets its meaning from what's going on in my heart and my mind and my intentions and my real desires and that kind of thing. And one way or the other, it does get communicated to the other person.
And as adults, I think you're really right, Jack. As adults, I can kind of see through that. I can, on some level, think, okay, this person is looking at me differently, and I can filter that through my adult perspective. But if I'm a child,
yeah.
And there's these adults, there's an adult with a heart that's heading toward me sexually, but on the outside, it's not really clear, that's when it becomes very confusing.
Yeah.
So what we've got to look at is really adult needs to take huge responsibility. What you're saying, not only in their behavior, but their underlying attitudes is extremely important for a child.
Yeah. And our temptation, of course, is to say, I set boundaries and I didn't cross over them, so it's okay. And what you're saying is, no, it's not okay. Because you may think that you didn't cross over the boundaries, but in your heart you crossed over the boundaries big time, and if you think that that was of no consequence, you're deceiving yourselves, because it had tremendous consequence.
And, of course, you're not just saying that we stepped over the line sexually, but we can step over the line in our hearts and not give our first loyalty to our spouse in many, many different ways.
Right, right.
And on the outside, it may look again like it's fine. I haven't done this, I haven't done this, I have done this, I haven't done that. But the reality is we haven't looked at our heart, and the intent was different than having loyalty to our spouse.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess I want to end this part of our discussion about emotional incest with a child by saying that even though the child may experience it as very special when they're young, it has lots of damage when children are older. Parents really need to take responsibility to not put that on a child. If parents are hurting, and many, many parents are, and they're seeking to have some kind of emotional support from somebody, they first need to work on their relationship with their spouse. They need to work on it really hard. If they don't have a spouse, say if they're divorced or their spouse is deceased, then they need to have a very good friend. But to rely on a child is just not an option, should not ever be an option for an adult to take. You know, I just said I was going to end it, but I don't want to.
Okay.
Earlier, I said that also parents can put an emphasis on children in a negative way. Now, we're not talking about emotional incest here, but we're putting a focus on a child so that we can distance ourselves from the issues in our relationship with each other.
In a negative way, remind me what you mean by that.
We could look at the child as being a problem.
Right, okay.
We focus on their problems, their school problems, their social problems, their whatever problems they might have. And the child may indeed be acting out, and they do need some focus. But very often parents will triangulate the child into their relationship, make the child the focus rather than make their relationship the focus. And in that way, they're really hurting the child also, because the child then is not only getting the focus from what they're doing, what they're behaving like, but they're also having this really heavy weight of, in a sense, taking care of the relationship between the spouses.
So let me see if I'm getting the picture here. If my spouse and I are having a hard time working on this relationship and connecting with each other, we can reduce the level of our stress in our relationship by demoting ourselves from being husband and wife to being fellow problem solvers.
Right.
Is that what we're doing?
And what we've done is we've then identified this child as the problem rather than the problem being between us. And so all the energy goes to them. What we're doing is we're reducing the anxiety between us, but we're increasing the problem with the child. You can imagine that, what's going to happen to the child then.
Is it because since this is necessary in order to solve the problem of our lack of connection in the marriage, an inordinate amount of focus and an inordinate amount of energy goes into the problem solving of the child?
That's right.
And so all this energy is being focused on this poor child?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And the child may indeed be a problem, but whenever I have a couple or a family that comes in and identifies the child as the patient, as the problem, I always redefine it. I always redefine it as the problem being in the context of the family. Very often what I do is I try to take the child out of the main arena and I look at the issues between the parents, if then we can focus on the issues between the parents, the child often can become a lot better. Because what a child needs more than anything is two parents that are loving each other and working really hard at it. So I often will not see a child who is identified as the problem. I will see the couple change the context that the child lives in that changes the whole situation for them. Again, Jack, let's take a break and we'll come back in just a few minutes.
You've heard it said that a college degree is not what it used to be. It seems these days colleges and universities are charging more and offering less. That's one of the reasons why Gutenberg College was developed. While many universities brag about their massive size and huge student body, Gutenberg College thrives on the idea that big is not always better. A student should not become a meaningless cog in some big education machine. A student should have the chance to interact in a meaningful way with his or her peers and professors. At Gutenberg, classes are small. Interaction with other students and with faculty is high. And education becomes interesting as well as rewarding. Imagine having a deep discussion about Aristotle or Shakespeare where your ideas are sincerely considered. Imagine struggling to understand the writings of Augustine and having a faculty tutor come alongside you to help, and you'll get a good idea of why Gutenberg exists. And yet, there are many other advantages to Gutenberg other than its size. If you want to know more about Gutenberg College and all that it offers, call 541-485-4801. That's area code 541-485-4801. Now, if you didn't have time to write that down, stay tuned. We'll repeat it again at the end of the program. Here again are Jack and Christine.
Well, I know we need to get on to the next way in which we can break our vow, but before we do that, it seemed to me that last week when we were talking about how friendship is both a very supportive and wonderful and profoundly meaningful kind of thing that can really enhance a marriage on the one hand. On the other hand, it can be really dangerous because we can cross over that border where a friendship ceases to be a friendship and it becomes sort of an adulterous relationship. One of the things that we didn't emphasize that I think might be remarkable or noteworthy that we really need to take note of is that can be a same-sex kind of relationship. A woman can shift her allegiance off of her man, off of her husband, to another woman friend and literally have shifted her loyalty and entered into a kind of quasi-marital relationship with that other woman without there being any sexual component or any physical attraction or any physical component to it at all. And yet it is still a violation, a kind of emotional adultery, a violation of the vow. And similarly, a man could do the same thing, shift his loyalty off of his wife onto a friendship with another man and have it become a kind of quasi-marital, quasi-committed kind of relationship. And there's no homosexuality going on at the physical level, but it's nonetheless still what we might label emotional adultery.
You're saying it's emotional adultery because I've switched my allegiance from my spouse as being the most important person to a very strong allegiance to somebody, in this case, of the same sex. Right. And I might not be physically involved with them at all, but I'm very, very emotionally involved with them in the intricacies of my life. So in a sense, I'm kind of married to them.
Right.
I don't have the certificate of marriage, and I don't consider myself even to be homosexual. And yet I'm very much invested in a very strong emotional relationship with that person.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, something that comes to mind here, though, that I want to bring up is it is very, very common that women have attraction to women and that men have attraction to men. It just comes up in my counseling so very often. And lots of times when people get into very, very connected relationships, physical things can and do occur. So if I'm really very, very invested in somebody of my own sex and that's accompanied by a strong dissatisfaction with my spouse, and that's accompanied by a very strong belief that I must stay married no matter what, and I'm kind of I'm stuck. Not that I have a moral commitment that I really want and I really am striving toward, but I'm kind of stuck. All those factors can work toward me having a relationship that really does turn into more than a physical, emotional relationship. It can also be very much a physical relationship. And, you know, one of the things I want to say as we're talking here is having those feelings does come up for people a lot, homosexual feelings. It really is quite common. The fact that it's there, though, is very different than how I act on those feelings.
Right. Well, do they emerge? You've described them as emerging out of a relationship that's already out of balance, that's already headed in the wrong direction and inappropriate anyway. You're not necessarily... Are you saying that that is usually the case, or that's not necessarily the case?
No, I don't think that's necessarily the case, okay. But you have fertile ground here.
Right.
With all those factors coming together, it just makes sense that, you know, we have a very strong God-given need to connect with other people. We need it. It's a good thing. And when we're not getting it from the one place that we need it, which is with our spouse, and we feel like we can't get it, and yet we're stuck there, we'll look at it in other places, whether emotionally and or physically. We are really in a precarious position because of our needs and because of our sinfulness, and we really need to be on the lookout to figure out if we want to live our lives toward godliness or if we want to live our lives just getting what makes us feel good.
Yeah.
And our culture says, live your life in a way that makes you feel good. My counselors now who are getting educated are not learning about deeper issues in life. They're learning about how to make someone feel better in 5 sessions.
We seems to me that we live in a culture that views homosexuality as largely a static fixture of our being, that either as God created us or as we have evolved or something like that. And so we think of ourselves as, I either am a heterosexual or I am a homosexual. And I would imagine in that context, then, when people sense that they have any sort of homosexual desires at all, it's really mind-boggling. I mean, they probably think in terms of, wow, I guess I'm not who I thought I was, or something like that.
I guess I am a homosexual if I have these feelings.
Yeah. What, you want to speak to that?
Oh, yes. That's exactly what happens to people. It's so frightening to people, because we do, just like you said, have this sense or this communication in our culture that says, if you feel this way, then that's who you are. That is the state of your being. And we are on really tricky ground here in talking about this. But many, many, many people have homosexual feelings. It doesn't make them a homosexual person. I think what makes a person a homosexual person is the small choices that they make over and over and over again. I can make, when I see these feelings coming up in me, I can either work toward nurturing them and making them bigger, or I can work against them. And that's a very simplistic view. I mean, many people have had this issue since they were very young, and that's another subject. But no, I really want to tell people out there that just because you have those feelings does not make you homosexual. It means that you're one of millions and millions and millions of people who also feel this way. And sometimes I wish that lots of people could be a fly on my wall and listen to people talk and come out with these issues and think that they're the only one. And they're simply not.
Yeah, I think philosophically we're at a time where we as Christians are not equipped or not prepared to think about these things. But there's two things that come up to me in my mind that seem to me where we've made a mistake. One is we don't understand our own sinfulness well enough. And since we don't understand our own sinfulness well enough, we don't realize how easy it would be for me to make wrong choices and that series of wrong choices that you're talking about. The more I've grown, the more I come to understand who I am, the more I come to understand the Bible, it becomes obvious to me that I could easily be a homosexual or I could easily become a homosexual. I know what my heart is made of. I know the kinds of passions that I'm capable of, and I know that I have choices to make about those passions and those desires that I experience. And all I would have to do is make different choices, and I could radically transform my whole sexual orientation. Probably most Christians are not prepared to say that, but I, you know, the more I live, the more I think, the more I study, the more I'm convinced that that's true. And yet our culture seems to suggest, you know, because of the politics of our culture, that there's really only two kinds of people. There's heterosexuals and homosexuals, and they are made of different stuff, and we need to take pride in the stuff that we're made of, and align ourselves with people that are like us, and so on. It's not that clean. All of us are capable of being homosexuals, it seems to me.
And Jack, it's like saying, I'm a thief or I'm not a thief. Well,
yeah.
You know, I could be a thief.
Yeah.
I don't steal things now, but I could go along the road of wanting and desiring and taking little things and then taking big things. And over time, I could really be a thief. I don't know why exactly we say that if I'm a homosexual, that's who I am, when we don't make ourselves something else, like a thief or like a good parent or a bad parent. We just don't make that distinction in other areas of our life. There's a lot more gray area. I struggle. I might say, you know, I struggle in my parenting. Doesn't make me designed as a bad parent. It's a struggle that I have to face into and work through.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference between the biblical worldview and the modern worldview out there in the culture around us, is the biblical worldview sees homosexuality as just a sin among sins. It's just one more way that we as people go wrong and rebel against God and don't think about ourselves accurately and make foolish choices. It's neither worse than any other sins, nor is it any better than any other sins. It's just part of the way that our brokenness manifests itself. The culture, on the other hand, in this inexplicable, strange, really odd kind of way, wants to take this one particular area and exalt it to the point of nobility and a virtue, that it's something that some people can rally around and be proud about and make the source of their identity. And radically different perspectives, radically different worldviews. And we need to recognize that we're talking past each other because we have such a different perspective on this.
Absolutely.
Christians and non-Christians.
Absolutely.
The other thing, it seems to me, is that that plays into that, and a kind of a philosophical mistake, is that we view being a heterosexual as just being really natural to people. That I think that's our perspective. And I think that may play into why our modern culture has said, well, you're either a homosexual and being homosexual is really natural to you, or you're heterosexual and being a heterosexual is really natural to you. The more I think about it, the more I realize that that's a mistake, because being a heterosexual, it's very natural in a culture that supports that. It's really natural in an environment, in a society that is always suggesting that's what you need to do, that's where you need to go, that's what's right, and that's what's good. I think what we're seeing in modern times is when that structure collapses and you no longer have that cultural support for that, it becomes less and less natural for people to be heterosexual.
It's natural for us to be sinners.
Exactly.
It's natural for us to take God-given good things like our need for connectedness and to pervert those, however we might pervert those.
Yeah. And what I'm suggesting is that even as God created us, we don't have these irresistible impulses to be heterosexual. We have these impulses to be sexual and to see the relationship between sexuality and intimate connectedness with another human being. I think that's kind of irresistibly built into us. But if we don't make the appropriate choices to recognize that just the inherent rightness of heterosexual marriage as God created it, if we don't see the rightness of that, then we could easily shift our desires, our passions, our affections, orient our sexuality toward the same sex rather than the opposite sex. It, mm-hmm. Clearly, life history, human experience teaches us that that's possible. People do that all the time. And I think we just need to face into the reality of that. That's a fact. Why am I a heterosexual? Because I have had people model appropriate human relationships for me, appropriate sexual relationships for me, sound marriage relationships to me. I have seen the rightness of that, the goodness of that, the benefit of that. I have read the Bible and have seen that was God's design, God's purpose from the very beginning. And so many, many factors have come into my life to shape my thinking along those lines and to encourage me to encourage that kind of expression of my sexuality in that orientation rather than another one. I have gone the other way? Absolutely. I think it's entirely thinkable.
Had you had a different context in which you grew up, different models, different information, not the Bible's information, but information that is contrary to the Bible, all of that could have gone into you being a person who is homosexual and who really feels pretty natural about it. They have come to think that that's an okay way of being.
And that brings me to another point, and that is feeling natural doesn't make something right. That's the other fallacy that we have. The thinking today is it comes so naturally to them, how can it be wrong? Well, it can be wrong because it violates what God had in mind. And sometimes what we need to do is go against what seems natural to us and do the right thing anyway. We were making that case, I believe, in the last conversation we had about men who have you made this case about men who it just seems natural to them, it just seems appropriate to them. It seems like it's the way God created the world, that men go out every weekend and hunt together and go to football games together and just do guy things together and let their wife stay home and take care of the kids. That can seem really natural to a man. But just because it seems natural to him doesn't make it right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a violation of everything God intended marriage to be.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think homosexuality, since we're on this subject, really seems right, has that right feeling for another reason. And that's because I am very much like other women. And we've made this case before also. But it's easy for me to connect with other women. It's easy for men to connect with other men.
Yeah.
We just kind of get it with each other. It's a lot more work for me to understand a man or for a man to understand a woman. Also, in the homosexual culture, there's a tremendous amount of support. There's just a very strong support system for people who are homosexual.
They have a common struggle with their own emotional coming to terms with their life, their lifestyle, their orientation, and how they relate to society. There's a crucible there that kind of brings them together.
And, of course, they feel very discriminated against, and so from a social perspective, they need someone else to cling to. And so they build a very strong social environment for themselves. We're talking a little bit about homosexuality, but I think we need to talk a lot about it. We're skimming over some very big issues, and certainly homosexuality is an enormous struggle for a lot of people and needs to be dealt with really seriously. And I don't think that's really the scope of what we're doing today.
Right, yeah. Well, I need to apologize. I sort of got us off on that rabbit trail. The point was simply that I can commit emotional adultery, leaving physical sexual intimacy aside. I can commit emotional adultery with someone who's a member of the same sex, and that's where we got off on this. And we need to be aware of that. A friendship can cross the boundary from being a profound and meaningful and helpful and constructive friendship to becoming a destructive quasi-marital relationship, quasi-marital commitment. And the fact that it's somebody of the same sex doesn't protect me from that. And I think it's important to see that. That's all to say that this third way, this third aspect of our vow that we can break is that I can shift the loyalty that I have promised to my wife or husband. I can shift that loyalty onto another human being, whether it's a friend or a child or even a parent, I suppose. We can shift that loyalty off of my spouse, and in doing so, I'm breaking the promise that I've made to them when I married them.
So what else does our marriage vow imply? Our marriage vow implies that we will behave in a way that communicates that our spouse is special. Now, I realize that we're almost at the end of our show, so we're just going to be starting to talk about that. But can you start us off just with a little bit of give us a little appetite for what we're going to be talking about next time?
Yeah, as we'll see, I think there are a wide variety of ways in which we communicate to our spouse that they are the most special person in my life. But one of the areas that's most sensitive, I think, is in the area of sexuality, and so we'll probably concentrate on a lot of issues around sexuality and what ways we can minimize the specialness of our spouse or at least communicate the wrong message. But let me just illustrate that. I can remember once being with a young married couple who were just recently married, and we were watching television, And at one point, I don't even remember what we were watching, but somebody came on the screen, and the woman said, "Wow, isn't he," and I don't remember, a piece of work or something to comment on how handsome or how attractive or how sexually attractive the man was. Very much, I suppose, the way that she might have interacted with some of her girlfriends before they were married or something, just kind of remarking on the attractiveness of this man. And it was kind of everyone kind of in the room, just it was struck simultaneously with kind of the oddness or the inappropriateness of that. And I reflected on the inappropriateness afterwards. I'm sure the woman didn't mean anything by it. It was just a kind of a knee-jerk reaction, probably a habitual way of thinking about what she was seeing on the screen. But objectively, probably the man was a very handsome man. The question is it appropriate for her to notice that? That is it appropriate for her, and I understand what I'm saying here, is it appropriate for her to acknowledge that as even relevant? I guess is perhaps the best way to say that. And what struck me is how that ought to have been irrelevant to her. And one of the things that I would like to maintain the next time we get together is whether it's a wife with respect to her husband or a husband with respect to her wife, and probably the men are a whole lot more guilty of this than women. One of the things that I need to resolve to do is I can't deny the objective beauty of women or attractiveness of women, something like that. I mean, it's silly to think that I would not notice what is out there to notice. But can I always frame my observation in terms of whether or not they are relevant? And can I make the resolution that the attractiveness of another woman is completely irrelevant to me? That the only one that is relevantly attractive to me is my wife. And it seems to me that when I can live a lifestyle of saying, of communicating in a myriad different ways, the beauty of other women is not interesting to me. The beauty of other women is not relevant to me. The only beauty that's relevant to me, my wife, is yours. That's the beauty that's relevant to me. I notice it, I enjoy it, I appreciate it, I acknowledge it, and it's relevant to me. By communicating that to my wife, what I'm saying to her is, you are the most special person in my life. Regardless of how you stack up in how you look and how attractive you are to other women, none of that matters to me, because you're attractive to me, and that's the one that's relevant. You know, the woman may realize objectively that there are more attractive women out there, but as long as I have communicated to her that it doesn't matter to me that there are, then I am sending the message to her that is a tremendous is tremendously fulfilling to her, because I'm communicating to her, you and you alone are important and special to me, and you alone are interesting to me.
You're giving her a lot of security in that.
Yeah.
And you're not just placing an emphasis on what you communicate here, I'm sure. You're communicating what's coming out of your heart.
Exactly.
Because you have set your heart in a direction to see your wife as most special, as most relevant to be observing, and decided and turned away from making the other people relevant. Because I think naturally we do make them relevant. Naturally we do look in the direction and stay in the direction of people that we view as very beautiful or attractive to us. And we need to just keep making our focus our spouse.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
In the last couple of programs, we've talked about what our marriage vow implies. Our marriage vow implies many things. It implies that we will strive to be connected to our spouse, that we'll become one flesh with them. Our marriage vow implies that we will respect our marriage partner as another person who is an individual, who is not us, and who we do not try to make us, but we come to see them and know them and understand them as a separate person from ourselves. And that way we are really loving them. Our marriage vow implies that our highest human loyalty needs to be to our spouse. We have very much focused on this in the last two programs. We need to have loyalty to our spouse over and above our friendships of the same sex, our friendships of the opposite sex. We need to have our human loyalty be toward our spouse and not toward our children, not toward other things, not toward our work, not toward our hobbies, but to direct our attention and our understanding and our time toward our spouse. It is in this way that our loyalty to God can be worked out in the footsteps of our lives every day.
In this program, we focus primarily on what we might call emotional incest, where I shift the loyalty that I have promised to my spouse onto a child, onto one of my children. And you were making some excellent points about the tragedy of that, in that if a father, for example, enters into a kind of quasi-marital relationship with a daughter, he is robbing that daughter of a father, he is robbing that daughter of a mother, and he's robbing that daughter of siblings. And the emotional trauma of that and the emotional impact of that is just tremendous.
And he's robbing that child of their childhood.
Of their childhood, yeah. But in any case, quite apart from the consequences of it, it's just wrong. It's exactly a violation of the thing that we have promised to our wife or our husband. We've promised them that we are going to connect with them and make them the highest loyalty in our life. If instead we forge that relationship with a child, we have violated our promise.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Next week, Jack and Christine continue the discussion on keeping and breaking marriage vows. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, Thank you for listening.